Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. James McHugh. He's professor of in the Department of Religion at the University of Southern California. We're speaking about a brand new OUP publication called An Unholy Brew, Alcohol in Indian History and Religions. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. There must be a backstory to this book, perhaps in a pub, who knows? But how did you come about researching this topic?
I guess there's kind of multiple backstories. I mean, my other book was on perfumes and smells. So I've always been, in a way, I was a bit torn when I was even a teenager. I kind of was really into science. And so I was always into sort of, potions and plants and things like that. And so that's kind of always informed most of the stuff I've done. And then when I was doing a master's years and years ago, I was really very fascinated by soma, the sort of mystery of the kind of soma. What is soma? I got really interested in that years ago. And that's a kind of intoxicating substance. And then when I was doing a smell book, there's this text called the Manasulasa, sort of the delight of the mind, sort of encyclopedic thing, has all, about things kings can get up to. And I'd always noticed, well, there's chapters on loads of stuff in there, but there was always a chapter on the king sort of staging a drinking party. And I'd had like a glance or two at it, and there were clearly loads of recipes for drinks in there, and then the description of the party and the drinking snacks, which was kind of, and I'd been meaning to look at it for ages, and eventually I did. And it was actually really difficult to make sense of. And so I realized, I started working on it, and then I was like, well, to make sense of that, I better look at something else and look at this thing and that thing. And it sort of snowballed, and I realized, then I was like, oh, actually, there isn't a book about this. So I'll write that book. It'll be kind of, when you write a book, you're going to be stuck with it for quite a few years. So you've got to be kind of like, never-endingly interested by it. So this topic seemed kind of good like that.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, isn't it? So 30,000 foot view, right? In the history of Indian religions, alcohol in the quote unquote history of Indian religions, what are some broad takeaways and perhaps even speak to something you navigate, I believe, in your introduction, in terms of, well, there might be some who think this is a rather offensive book, but if they read it, they wouldn't think so. Talk about that a little bit.
Definitely don't want to sort of tell that kind of story where there was some sort of ancient golden age of sort of permissiveness. Absolutely, definitely wasn't like that. I mean, I guess sort of morally speaking, I mean, the sort of ins and outs of why people do and don't drink and why they think it's bad or why they think it's utterly forbidden sometimes, they're very complicated, it turns out, in fact. It's not just sort of one sort of blanket ban. But I mean, generally, morally speaking, I'd say it's always, from earliest periods, you can see there's a bit of a sort of mixed attitude, even in the Rig Veda, towards drinking, where it's kind of present, but it's kind of maybe frowned on, or it's associated with people doing regrettable things. And this just develops over the centuries into, you know, there's some people celebrating it, enjoying it. And even those people will sort of admit it makes you do stupid things sometimes. And then there's like quite a lot of people for various reasons saying it's just utterly terrible and should never go near it. So, you know, even in the sort of the sort of bad side of it, it's super complicated, in fact, and more complicated than I'd imagined. And then when you kind of come to the actual sort of more positive side of drinking, or the positive spin on drinking, it's just like, yeah, again, there's just so much to say. That's what really struck me, is how many different drinks there are, how it changes over the centuries. It's not very stable. I think sometimes people tend to think sort of ancient world, old world stuff just is very sort of stable, but it's very changing. There's a lot of variety of drinks, and then all sorts of different contexts where it seems people drank. So big take home is it's super complicated, whether you're on the sort of positive or the negative side.
So tell us, that was one of the fascinations of mine as well. Long before I started Hindu studies, which must have been pretty close to 20 years ago, I actually... did a bunch of work in the hospitality industry as a food and beverage and drink. So it's so fascinating to read some of the different sorts of drinks and sort of that is sort of like an ancient mixology. What are some of the different drinks that you've come across?
I think it's important to mention that the sort of most ancient category is this drink Sudar. And in a way, sudar kind of just means, you know, it's such a sort of important word. It kind of almost, one of these words that almost means anything. So sometimes sudar just means sort of alcoholic drink generally. But like, it can also mean a sort of smaller subsection of drinks made from grains. And so cereal grains, and there's lots of types of sudar, and it seems very, very ancient ones, they're made in one way, but like after a certain period, you know, say 2000 years ago onwards, sudars are made, and they still do this in parts of South Asia, they're made kind of in this way, using kind of, you turn the starch of the grains into sugar using a mold, and then have a yeast as well, and probably loads of the microbes and herbs as well. I mean, they didn't think of it in terms of yeast and microbes, they just thought they were adding this sort of cake of transformative substance. But that's actually the same method used in, like, say, East Asia, Southeast Asia. So it's this kind of pan-Asian method. And it seems to be lots of types of sudar. So you've got to think, you know, it's in the same family as things like Chinese yellow wine or sake or various Korean drinks, loads of drinks. And but there were loads of types. There's black ones, white ones, clear ones, pale ones, with different herbal mixtures. So that was a very big, complex affair. And that's the kind of most ancient type of drink. But then, you know, in South Asia, they had, you know, they were very sophisticated with sugarcane at an early period. So they had, and if you think with sugarcane, you can do things with sugarcane juice, or you can make some sort of jaggery type stuff. It's sort of, it's like dark brown sugar, but sort of solids. And so the flavors would be very different. So there were various sugarcane wines. There was imported grape wine from places in the Northwest and later on probably in Iran area. Palm toddy. Let's think, mahua. There's this drink mahua, which is sort of unique South Asia as far as I know. I'm pretty sure it is. And this is a big tree that has these flowers full of nectar that you can ferment. And they weren't distilling at that point, I don't think. But, you can sort of ferment it into it. And apparently it's got a very distinctive taste. I didn't manage to taste it. And then there's a lot of more mixed drinks that are kind of, you know, fruit juice plus honey plus sugar cane plus herbs. A lot of the drinks, in fact, they're almost all a bit of a mixture. This, you know, if you kind of like, you know, people are into, say, natural wine or German beer, it'll all be very obsessed on its sort of simplicity and purity of ingredients. And for the most part, apart from grape wine, for the most part, these ancient drinks tend to not be like that. They tend to have like all sorts of stuff thrown in for sort of complexity. So this idea that sort of ancient means kind of simple and pure is, that's just a mistake.
Where do we see drinks most stringently prohibited? Where do we see the most sort of stigmatization of alcohol consumption?
Well, it's, you know, there's sort of a few strands to that. There's a kind of discourse of vices for kings, and that can be like they shouldn't drink at all, or it could be all more about moderation. But that's very important, in fact, even though it might not be sort of the most strict prohibition. You know, obviously, if the king gets really drunk and makes some terrible decision to sort of burn down a village or something, that's like particularly bad. So that's like, that's one. And then, you know, maybe on the more religious side, a lot of groups in society who are sort of aiming to sort of live a particularly sort of ritually controlled or sort of morally sort of controlled life. So say very observant Buddhist nuns, Jains, and especially in the in groups of Hindus, Brahmins, they would say. But then within the sort of Hindu, at least within the classical law, I mean, the classical Hindu law has Brahmins drinking, no drinking at all. And then it has the other two twice born Varnas, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. They can drink, but they just can't drink stuff made from grains, which would be a lot of drinks, in fact, that they can't drink. That's probably because those grain ones resemble this sura used in Vedic rituals, sort of the most archaic sura, which is the most forbidden. And it makes them a little bit Brahmin-like in the sense that they are subject to some abstinence. But it's Brahmins who are very marked by this. There's a story where there's a guy pretending to be a Brahmin and he's been drinking. And he's, I can't remember why he's pretending to be a Brahmin now, but they can smell it on his breath. And that gives it away. It's like, well, you can't be a Brahmin if it smells of booze. You know what I mean? So it's almost a sort of, you know, it's sort of mark of Brahminhood in this sort of classical period to be abstaining. But of course, there's side by side with that in the legal texts, there's all this stuff about very specific castes and drinks and things like that, varnas and drinks. There's also like, you know, well-known sort of quotes in the legal texts and beyond just about like, you're just best off not drinking, it makes you do stupid stuff. You know what I mean? And they're kind of applicable as a sort of blanket, you know, don't drink, it's stupid way. So that, you know, so it's complicated. You know, there's these blanket kind of advices, but then there's these very, very technical things. And then obviously what people were actually doing is probably slightly more complicated and different again. And we don't really have access to that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important distinction in terms of perhaps an idealized society or sense of conduct in texts versus who knows what people were doing. So the flip side of that, where do we see in Indian religions in the history of India less prohibition or enjoyment or indulgence in drink?
Yeah, it is sort of in a religious context. Most of the sort of enjoyment you'll see in texts that aren't going particularly down a massive sort of religious path, as it were, or where you sort of see a Brahminical morality text or sort of thing on sort of Buddhist monks' conduct or something like that. You see a lot, you know, there's quite a lot of drinking in the epics, because there is an element you do see that sort of there's a bit of a Kshatriya ethos. But there's drinking sometimes connected with that realm. Again, that's the realm where it could become a vice, it could become a problem, it could make people do dumb things. Needs to be, controlled, but not necessarily completely prohibited. So you see some of it there, and then you see a lot of it in things like poetry, where you've got erotic scenes, descriptions of kind of country festivals and things like that. And then some of our evidence actually is sort of religious. So you'll have like quite a lot of Buddhist narratives. They'll be sort of telling stories about why not to drink, but they'll, you know, in the process describe, you know, drinking scenarios. Yet again, how realistic any of this is very debatable. But, you know, you get references to everywhere. But the kind of positive depictions, I guess the most positive ones are in poetic texts with a sort of erotic leaning, where drink's kind of seen as this sort of inhibition, almost like an aphrodisiac, sort of removes inhibitions, gets people warmed up a bit.
Do we see ritualized drinking?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of that. There's one rather obscure Vedic sacrifice called the Sautramani, which I have not got time to get into here, but it's kind of seen as exceptional because normally you wouldn't have any drink involved in a Vedic sacrifice. And soma, obviously, is the if you're going to have something that kind of causes a sort of mind-altered state, that would be soma in that context. But there's one where you're actually offering and perhaps consuming some sura, which is kind of ritually transformed into soma partly. The main thing about that sacrifice, though, sort of aside from what's going on with it, is that it's seen as very sort of anomalous. You know, so you will have, say, Jain texts, later Jain texts, kind of pointing out the anomalous nature that there's this one Vedic sacrifice with sura, but then you're not meant to have sura, so how does this all add up? So that's one thing, but it's a bit of an oddball, and like I said, it's sort of well known as a sort of anomaly. And then you get drinking in some, by no means all, some what you might call tantric rituals, which kind of, yeah, again, hard to explain. Basically, a lot of these tantric texts that mention drinking, the actual sort of tantras themselves just sort of say to do it. They don't necessarily explain why you're doing it. They do allude to various myths where there is a kind of divine origin to sura and things. But say, in the book, I focus more on Abhinavagupta, a Kashmiri sort of interpreter and sort of developer of certain forms of tantra. And he connects it to a sort of non-dualistic philosophy where by doing something that for Brahmins would be extremely sort of illegal, sinful, transgressive, by doing that, it's a sort of cognitive ritual where you're sort of living out the fact that actually everything is divine, everything is the absolute in this sort of very, very kind of carefully demarcated ritual moment. You know, this thing that's actually really forbidden in everyday life actually is really, completely sacred and God, basically, sort of the absolute. And so, you know, in this very controlled situation, you kind of apprehend that by doing something, you know, supposedly bad in normal life. But there's other interpretations as to what is going in some tantric texts. There's a lot more to be said about that. I only sort of, it's a long chapter, but I really did, it is the tip of the iceberg, to be honest.
So speaking of that long chapter, talk a little bit about the structure of the book to sort of inform those who may want to dive into it. Like, how's the book laid out?
Oh, yeah, that's something developed sort of naturally, but it's almost like how I did my research, is because when I was, say, looking at legal texts, they get very into, especially later Hindu ones, they get very into the ins and outs. They have all these long lists of drinks and, you know, different varnas can have this and that and that. And I was like, well, why? You know what I mean? Like, as far as, you know, so in a way, from an outsider's point of view, it's just like they're alcoholic drinks. Like, why is anyone worrying about dividing them into categories and things? And so I was like, well, to understand these legal texts, I've got to have a feel for what these drinks are. And so basically, it all kind of came down to sort of working out what on earth these drinks were in the first place. So I start out drinks, and there's two big chapters where they're basically like an encyclopedia of different types of drinks with some of the techniques of making as well. And then I talk about the brewing culture, what we can know about the sort of maybe the public, because it seems that a lot of the brewing went to pub drinking house type places, they brewed and sold. So that chapter is about brewing and these kind of public houses, as it were, pubs. And then there's another chapter on more elite drinking, which would be done in private. So that's about drinking. So it's drinks, drinking, and there's some stuff on medically regulated drinking there as well. And then I move into, then there's a second part of the book where I move into almost like reflection or sort of higher order dealing with it. So there I start with a load of mythological or epic incidents that are sort of prominent when it comes to drink. And you need to know those, because actually once you start reading, say, I don't know, sort of texts on vices or say Buddhist, you know, speeches about the evils of drink, they will allude to quite a lot of that material. So you sort of need to know that. So I do these myths and stories, and then I get into the legal materials, so the moral legal materials, various traditions. It's kind of, there's a lot there. That's a very long chapter. And then the Tantra, because in a way, because the Tantra is sort of, at least some interpretations of the Tantra, is sort of messing with those legal traditions. I put that then, because you can only when you've understood all that stuff can you kind of really get a rich feel for how exactly some of these tantric methods and interpretations are working. And then at the end, I kind of have a few comments about sort of what happened next. You know, does it all sort of vanish? You know, what do we know about what happened next? And so I look at some much later texts on hints of survivals of these practices or these ideas.
And just to be clear, this is a textual project. The evidence for this is all text, correct?
Mostly. I did, in order, especially to understand the drinks, I did some field work and looked at a lot of stuff on comparative fermentation methods. There's a lot published on that as well. There's a huge thing. So you can imagine there's like all the microbiology of it and stuff. People are really interested. It's kind of important source for stuff. And that was really helpful. So that I am using the text, but especially to interpret the drinks and get a good feel for them, I looked very broadly at the ways, all sorts of traditional ways people make drinks around the world today and in the past. So there is a kind of practical or at least kind of, you know, outside the Sanskrit text influence coming into making sense of these recipes or these drinks that...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
What are some of the stories we see in the epics that involve drinking?
There's quite a lot. I mean, there's some of the, I guess the most famous, the most iconic is this classic at the towards the end of the Mahabharata, where Krishna's sort of kinsmen and the Yadavas or the Andakas and the Vrishnis, it's kind of a bit, I won't give the whole story, but basically they, you know, they've been sort of cursed that they're going to be sort of destroyed, and various things happen, and you know, Krishna, you know, realizes that this curse is sort of coming to fruition and sort of bans drink because he knows they'll, you know, that'll make things a bit safer if people aren't kind of getting drunk and getting into fights and things. But then one day they all go out, they all go to the beach basically, and take a little drink with them. In a way, it's a bit of an exception. It's like a festival. It's out of town. So, you know, are they really, you know, they're not really breaking the rules. They're kind of in a different space. And they drink and there's this club appears. I'm not going to get into the club. That's a whole separate story. But this sort of big, this club sort of manifests in various ways. It's the book of the club, like a club, like a Captain Caveman kind of club.
I was going to say, for those listening, I'm sure they're all familiar with Indic studies, but, you know, when we're talking about drinking and clubbing, we don't mean, you know,
exactly.
The venue. We mean the weapon, but go on.
Yeah, the weapon. And then all the men, at least, not Krishna, not Balarama, but all the men, they sort of mutually kill each other in a really horrible way. You know, there's like fathers and sons killing each other, and it's horrible. And this... Well, one, it's actually quite a short book. It's very easy. I mean, you can easily find it online to read if anyone's interested. But then this becomes, and not just for Hindu sources, but you get this in Buddhist and Jain sources, it's the sort of proverbial, awful, tragic, messed up thing that happens when people drink. And actually, what's interesting about that is, like, a lot of the classical Hindu lore that I'm dealing with is probably later than that. But, you know, technically, they are permitted to drink by caste, by Varna law, at least in later periods. And so it's not, this isn't sort of sinful Brahmins drinking. This is kind of people who, you know, it's kind of part of their culture to drink sometimes. And nevertheless, they get so drunk, they do all this terrible stuff. In a way, by making it sort of legally permissible drinking, that sort of removes that sin aspect and just makes it pure, you will do appalling things if you drink. And so it is very much the proverbial disastrous drinking scenario.
Cautionary tale.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Why is the book called An Unholy Brew?
Ah, yeah, that's, well, it's a bit of a weird, it's a bit of a funny story. I sort of chose that very early on, as almost as the kind of, when you're sort of like, you know, proposing a book and applying for grants and things, and I hadn't written the book at that point. And then as it developed, I realized that perhaps wasn't the best title. But then, I'd mentioned it to various people, and a few people had mentioned it in their publications. I'd written papers where I've gone, see, McHugh, forthcoming, and unholy. So I was kind of stuck with it. I mean, the unholy there is unholy in that sense of, you know, some, I don't know, it's not very common, but you might go, oh, that was an unholy racket this morning when the trash van went past. A sort of, you know, it doesn't mean unholy, like, literally. It means just kind of, like, big and spectacularly noisy or something like that. So there's that element that it's and brew in the sense of a mixture. It was meant to have sort of the double meaning of one hell of a mess and mixture, or, you know, melting pot or something like that. But actually, if I'd been able to, I'd have probably gone for The Ocean of Sudar would have been the title, but it was too late to. It was way too late to change it. Writing books is,
The Ocean of Surah. Just from a perspective of, I do a lot of naming for courses and marketing and things for the public, but the vibe, shall we say, between An Unholy Brew and The Ocean of Surah is so night and day. It's comical. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, well, these things happen.
So, either way, it's an intriguing title.
Thank you.
Tell us about Soma. I know you have a little appendix dedicated to it, but Soma, surely we must know what Soma is, right?
I don't think we do.
I'm teasing.
People get so into it. And it's really fascinating. I mean, it's like one of the reasons I got interested in this whole thing in the first place. I actually put Soma in appendix as I mentioned in the book, because it's really weird. You'll give a talk for an hour or something on like all the alcohol. You'll mention, there'll be in the Q&A, there'll be like a 2-minute Soma question, and that almost anyone remembers about that talk is the Soma part. So I was just a bit annoyed with Soma sort of taking over all the time. So it's in the appendix. And I guess I was more interested in, well, there were some theories early on, in fact, that soma might be an alcoholic drink. So I sort of had to deal with them because they're sort of part of the sort of historiography of alcohol is these sort of soma theories that aren't, you don't tend to run into so much anymore. Probably didn't have time to ferment, so wouldn't have been a fermented drink. And I guess I got more interested in the kind of meaning of soma and the kind of soma ritual. It's funny, I was just talking about it with a class this week, and we were just sort of thinking about the sort of scenario of one of these soma rites and, you know, who's there, including the gods, if you know what I mean, you know, who's involved. And I was asking the students to try and translate it to their experience, and they were sort of saying, oh, it's like some local politician having a massive national politician around, and there's lots of very, very, very good chefs presenting dinner and hands the national politician a very good bottle of wine. And in a way, you can sort of think of it like that. There's so much else going on with these rituals. I mean, it's not quite the same as that in many ways. It's ancient Vedic stuff. So it's like really not quite the same as that. But that's kind of how they wanted to translate it. And I guess the value of that image is that, you know, in that type of scenario, the most important thing to understanding what's going on there is not the, you know, the sort of neurochemistry of the alcohol that's in the bottle of wine. You know what I mean? And in terms of if you had descriptions of that event or speeches people made about that event, describing the wine and the pleasure of the wine, you might not necessarily use those to try. If you didn't know what was in that bottle, it was wine, but you didn't know, it might be tricky to kind of go from descriptions of such a kind of rich and complex social event to just going, oh, well, you know, this is going on, they're saying this, therefore it must be this kind of drug, like a hallucinogen or something like that, which I think sort of methodologically there's, you know, you're missing a lot of steps and you ignore, you're sort of you're scraping off a lot of other stuff that's going on in the ritual there. So I'm not sure if it's sort of possible to find out, to be honest, but you know, I think it's kind of cool that you know, it's this sort of mystery that sort of keeps prompting lots of reflection and analysis on the topic. So I mean, I never want to sort of put down a scholarship on it because it's all fascinating and it's very generative of interesting ideas.
Fascinating. Was there anything else about the book that you hope we touch on?
Not particularly. I think we've sort of gone over most things, really. It's pretty long, but hopefully it's pretty accessible. I guess that's one thing I tried very hard. I worked with two separate editors to make it as sort of smooth and digestible as possible, because partly I really did want, say, somebody like a sommelier with an interest in history of alcohol to be able to more or less follow it, or somebody who does, say, classics, who just sort of like, you know, ancient Greek stuff, that they'd be able to follow it. I've tried very hard to make it more accessible, which might maybe have simplified a few things from the sort of Indian studies side of things. But yeah, that's my hope, is that a slightly broader audience can read it.
Well, that is also the hope of the New Books Network, accessibility
exactly.
for a broader audience. So I'm with you. Great. Well, thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Excellent. Thank you. And good to meet you. And good to chat. All right. See you.
Yes. For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. James McHugh of the University of Southern California, on his brand new 2021 OUP publication, An Unholy Brew Alcohol in Indian History and Religions. And until next time, stay safe, stay sane. I wanted to say something about drinking, but I won't. Just continue contemplating the pros and cons of alcohol. Take care.